this is going to be a very long-term process that's going to have monumental ups and downs.
Plans move ahead for a second Trump-Kim summit. It's Tuesday, December 4th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Check us out on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, trauma for Australia's first responders. Vietnam becomes an economic model, mourning the loss of a former U.S. president. Artificial intelligence for medicine, and one of the best places to hear jazz. It's all on today's VOA Asia. South Korean President Moon Jae-in told reporters on a flight from Argentina to New Zealand, President Donald Trump told him during the G20 summit he has a very favorable view toward North Korean leader Chairman Kim Jong-un and likes him. The South Korean leader said Mr. Trump asked him to convey to Kim he wants him to implement the rest of their denuclearization agreement from their first meeting in Singapore, and he would fulfill Chairman Kim's wishes. Mr. Trump said Saturday he expects to have a second summit with the North Korean leader in January or February, with three venues for the meeting under consideration. And South Korea's unification ministry said it is still possible that Kim will make an unprecedented visit to Seoul before the year is out. Mr. Moon visited Pyongyang in September. Harry Kazianis is director of defense studies at the Center for the National Interest. And he tells VOA's Victor Beatty the saying is that flattery will get you everything, but he doubts that includes Kim Jong-un's nuclear weapons.
I think right now we're in a little bit of a holding pattern. I think the Trump administration is probably trying to reassess its North Korea policy. I think they understand that Kim Jong-un could very well wait the administration out if he wanted to. Let's face it, he's a 34-year-old young man. He wants to be dictator of North Korea probably until his mid-80s or even longer. So I think he understands his time horizons are a lot longer than Moon Jae-in or Donald Trump. So I think North Korea is also probably thinking about its policy going into the new year. I overall think, though, we're not in a bad position. I know there's been a lot of talk that the talks are collapsing, that they're falling apart. I don't really buy that. I think if you're going to try and create a new relationship with North Korea, which that's what this administration and Moon Jae-in are trying to do, you're not going to do that overnight. You're not going to erase 70 years of animosity, of hatred, of no trust between any of these parties in one summit or five summits. This is going to be a very long-term process that's going to have monumental ups and downs. But the most important thing here that has to be done by Moon, by Trump, and even Kim, is they all have to trust the process and buy into the process. And so far, I think they've done that, but we're a long way to go before we see any really big, tangible results.
There have been criticisms that the Singapore summit last June was very vague in its declarations. If a second summit takes place, will there be more specifics? Will the U.S. insist on it?
I think there has to be some measurable outcome. And I think there is a deal on the table here. When I was actually in Seoul back in September, sort of monitoring events in the third inter-Korean summit, there was a deal that was floated that basically came out of Kim Jong-un's mouth. What he said is he was willing to put the Yongbyon nuclear facility on the table, which is a very large nuclear facility, in exchange for what he dubbed corresponding measures. Those are his words. It's been floated that that could be some sort of sanctions relief, or that could be an end-of-war declaration signed by the United States, North Korea, and South Korea. I think that's what Kim is looking for. Because we have to remember, if Kim Jong-un is going to give up his nuclear weapons, his generals, his lieutenants, the party apparatchik around him is going to be very nervous in doing that. We have to remember that is North Korea's insurance policy. Giving that up essentially leaves him naked to invasion. So he needs to get a win to bring back to his own people. Just like any other country, Kim Jong-un has his own political actors that he has to answer to. So I think if Donald Trump was smart, he would give that end-of-war declaration, and I think that would give Kim the ability to start weaning down that nuclear weapons program. I think that there's a real chance of that opening.
And what are the concerns that the North is continuing to build up its nuclear and missile capacity in the meantime?
That was always something that was going to be a danger, and that shouldn't be any shock. Any country that wants to be a full-fledged member of the nuclear club is going to continue to build out its arsenal. There's no shock to that. I know there was, you know, reports in the New York Times saying we're being deceived. We're actually not being deceived, but it is very frightening to see in black and white on the front page of newspapers like the New York Times that literally the satellite imagery that they're building more nuclear weapons. But even a year ago, the North Koreans could kill millions of people with nuclear weapons. They can kill even millions more now. But this is the reason why we need to get an agreement with North Korea. And this is why we need to continue the diplomatic process.
In a statement following the meeting between Presidents Trump and Xi Jinping of China Saturday, the White House said great progress has been made on North Korea with the goal of being a nuclear-free Korean peninsula. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Asia stocks rally after U.S.-China truce on tariffs. China-U.S. tariff truce is an opportunity with tight time frame. Next Trump-Kim meeting likely early next year. North Korea studies Vietnam for development ideas. Argentina and China sign deals strengthening ties after G20. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories when you visit VOA Asia at Facebook. Also stop by our website, voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. As emergency services battle catastrophic brush fires in Queensland and clean up after cyclonic conditions in New South Wales, World First research in Australia has revealed the mental health burden borne by first responders. It has found high levels of psychological distress among police officers and other emergency personnel, with a quarter of retired first responders reporting experiences of post-traumatic stress disorder. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
A modified Boeing 737 passenger aircraft drops 15,000 litres of water on fires near the Queensland city of Mackay. Across the state, emergency crews have been battling more than 100 bushfires. Further south, Sydney, Australia's biggest city, was pounded Wednesday by a once-in-a-100-year storm. An emergency volunteer died in the huge clean-up operation. Greg Murphy is from the New South Wales State Emergency Service.
I can confirm that one of our members, one of the SES family, collapsed and died today while on an SES job. Our sympathies are with the family and all of their colleagues that are actually feeling the effects of this sad event.
For the first time, research in Australia has painted a detailed picture of the psychological health of past and present police officers and other emergency service personnel. The charity Beyond Blue surveyed 21,000 people. It found that those on the front line of natural disasters, accidents and crimes have a higher risk of developing mental health conditions, which are associated with traumatic events as well as poor workplace culture. Steve McDowell is a former paramedic and founded the No More Neglect Help Group to advise those suffering from acute stress.
I developed post-traumatic stress disorder from my workplace. And as a result of my experiences, I formed a support group in 2015. It helps people who are suffering from mental distress who are first responders. A lot of experiences have to do with bullying in the workplace, a lack of support in the workplace, and a feeling of isolation.
The survey found that emergency workers in Australia are about twice as likely to suffer severe psychological distress or be diagnosed with a mental illness than the general population. The research will be used as a framework for the police, as well as the ambulance and fire services, to help workers and volunteers better cope with some of the most challenging and dangerous jobs in Australia. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, U.S. President Donald Trump said he is likely to meet North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in January or February, and that three sites for their second meeting are under consideration. Trump added that at some point he will invite Kim to the United States. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Vietnam, a fast-growing country that's liberal on trade and has friends in multiple countries, is now offering to help advance North Korea, a fellow communist state that's impoverished as well as distrusted by the West. North Korea will want to learn from Vietnam how South Korean investors have come to be responsible for about 20% of Vietnamese exports. Song Sen-won, an economist with the private banking unit of CIMB in Singapore, says the North is looking for an inter-Korean connection.
It is more interested in terms of what to learn from Vietnam. So why it failed initially, but it seems to be gaining better traction this time around.
Gaining traction, he says, after the high inflation before the global financial crisis 10 years ago. Southeast Asia beyond Vietnam is on North Korea's radar, too. Last year, the Brookings Institution Research Group said in a report that while China accounts for about 85% to 90% of trade with North Korea, seven Southeast Asian countries did business worth $181 million with Pyongyang in 2015. Brookings adds that some North Korea-Southeast Asia trade may violate UN resolutions and involve arms shipments. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for contributing this report. Coming up, a farewell for a U.S. president. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia. Asia stocks rallied Monday on the news that the United States and China, the world's two largest economies, would not impose any new tariffs during a 90-day grace period during which the two sides are to negotiate a detailed agreement. The U.S. market indexes also finished up more than 1%. Your stock rises with The More You Know. Visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, President Donald Trump has proclaimed Wednesday a day of national mourning following the death Friday of former President George H.W. Bush at age 94, the 41st president who presided over the end of the Cold War and led an international coalition that ousted Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein's forces from Kuwait in 1991. President Bush also served as U.S. ambassador to China, United Nations ambassador, and head of the Central Intelligence Agency. Two men who served in the first Bush administration, former Secretary of State James Baker and former Defense Secretary and Vice President Dick Cheney, appeared on Fox News Sunday broadcast as Baker described Mr. Bush as among the country's best one-term presidents.
He didn't blow his own horn. One of his wonderful character traits was to let other people take credit. That was something he was brought up with, and that's the way he operated, but he was an extraordinarily, if you think about it, you go back and look at the record, he was an extraordinarily consequential president of the United States, particularly in the arena of foreign affairs.
His knowledge of foreign leaders, people he'd worked with over the years, his understanding of the military, his willingness to support the military. We gave him a very long list of things we wanted to have in the Gulf before we launched the offensive weapons. He didn't turn them down on anything. He approved all of them and said, all right, now show me how you're going to do it. He was a great leader.
Former chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff and National Security Advisor Colin Powell said the 41st president, a combat naval aviator in World War II, knew the costs of war and tried to avoid using force in the first Gulf War. He said he led a life of quality, honesty, and humility, and in his public service, always kept the best interests of the American people in mind. Larry Sabato is a political science professor at the University of Virginia and the founder and director of its Center for Politics. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty Mr. Bush's legacy has grown with time.
It's pretty obvious as people look back and as people are recollecting the Bush presidency, it looks a heck of a lot better than it did at the end of it. Bush, of course, was defeated for re-election, and most people at the time considered him a failed president. But now I think we can see in retrospect that he was actually quite successful, arguably the best one-term president we ever had. He may be tied with John Adams and James K. Polk, but he's at least up at the very top end of a pretty large group of one-term presidents. So it's funny how history works, but the good thing is that with time, you could have reconsideration.
A stellar career, starting with as a young man in the U.S. Navy during the Second World War, a congressman, CIA director, ambassador to China, vice president, and now president. Quite a career.
What a life. What a career. It is amazing. And, of course, Bush was our last World War II veteran to serve as president, so he ended an era. He was a hero in World War II, but he was the son of a senator. And as the son of a senator, he grew up in a political household. So no one was surprised when he started running for office from Texas in the 1960s. What people often forget is he wasn't very successful. He lost two Senate races. He won two races for the House of Representatives. But he went from there to the United Nations. He also served as a liaison to China before we had a full-fledged ambassador. And finally, he was head of the CIA. Then he served after the Carter term. He served two terms as vice president, one term as president. It ended badly with his defeat, but I think all of that was washed away in 2000 when his son was elected president.
You remember the famous words, read my lips, no new taxes, but wasn't that really overshadowed by the fact that he helped win the Cold War or presided over the Cold War, and then, of course, the coalition against Saddam Hussein?
Absolutely. I was 20 yards from the podium when George Bush uttered those words at the Republican National Convention in 1988. And even then, people wondered whether conditions would permit him to keep them. Of course, he did not keep the promise. He did not hold to those words. And it hurt him badly in 1992. Oddly enough, the other thing that hurt him badly was the fact that he skillfully helped the end of the Cold War. He did not grandstand. He didn't run to Berlin to dance on the wall once it had fallen. He realized that these new emerging countries needed time and space and no goading, no grandstanding from the United States to make their way. But essentially, it eliminated foreign policy as a major consideration in the 1992 election, and that helped Bill Clinton, who had no foreign policy experience.
AP leads their story, Bush mourned as great statesman, man of uncommon decency.
To be honest, at one point in history, it would not have been exceptional to have a president who obeyed and appreciated the norms of the American system and of the presidency, who was civil, who was kind to people, and who rose above petty squabbles. But, you know, things have changed, particularly in the last couple of years. And the contrast between George H.W. Bush and the current president could not be more stark.
Mr. Bush's body now lies in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda, where it will remain through Wednesday. A state funeral will follow at the National Cathedral before his body is returned to Texas and buried on the grounds of the Bush Presidential Library in College Station Thursday. This news from VOA Asia, China and the United States have agreed to put tariffs on hold and give negotiations a chance. But the short 90-day period the two have to finish negotiations will require quick steps, according to analysts. China pledges to purchase what the White House calls substantial amounts of agricultural, energy, industrial, and other products. We pledge to give you the top stories every day on VOA Asia Facebook. Now on VOA Asia, doctors may soon have new ways of diagnosing and treating patients in ways that were never humanly possible with the help of artificial intelligence and machine learning. A team of scientists at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles are developing a way of using machine learning to identify specific types of breast cancer tumors. And they say it's just the beginning of what the computer can do. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has details from Los Angeles.
This is a classroom for artificial intelligence, or AI. Its teacher, Rishi Rawat, is feeding the computer more samples of cancer cells.
So they're like a computer brain, and you can put the data into them, and they will learn the patterns and the pattern recognition that's important for making decisions.
Decisions by doctors to determine the best treatment for their patients.
Machines are not going to take over the place of doctors. Computers will not treat patients, but they will help make certain decisions and look for things that the human brain can't recognize these patterns by itself.
For example, once a cancerous tumor is removed from a patient with breast cancer, the doctors still have to treat the patient to reduce the risk of recurrence. The type of treatment depends on the type of cancer and whether the tumor is driven by estrogen.
And so what the pathologist has to do is to count what percentage of the cells here are brown versus what percentage are not.
This process could take days or even longer.
In developing nations, they don't necessarily have access to do this at all. And so there's a great need there to be able to diagnose these cancers correctly.
The computer can do something better than just count cells. AI can recognize complicated patterns on how the cells are arranged, with the hope in the near future of making a quick and more reliable diagnosis that is free of human error.
Are they disordered? Are they in irregular spacing? What's going on exactly with the arrangement of cells in the tissue?
We can do this instantaneously for almost no cost in the developing world.
Scientists say the time is ripe for the marriage between computer science and cancer research.
All of a sudden, we have the computing power to really do it in real time. We have the ability of scanning a slide to high enough resolution so that a computer can see every little feature of the cancer. So it's a convergence of technology. We couldn't have done this. We didn't have the computing power to do this several years ago, but now it's all changed.
The research now was on breast cancer, but doctors predict artificial intelligence will eventually be used to help treat patients with all forms of cancer. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Presidents, prime ministers, and Hollywood stars have visited from what the outside looks like an old and shabby jazz club in New Orleans. In this case, however, appearances are quite deceiving. Musicians call this place the holy grail of clubs and home to American jazz. Maye Kay went to the famous Preservation Hall that tells the story of jazz.
Nothing reflects America's diverse musical identity than jazz, a genre that originated in the African-American communities of New Orleans, Louisiana. And nowhere is jazz as alive and as vibrant as in its birthplace. But one place in the city is synonymous with the history and cultural tradition of jazz, Preservation Hall.
That immigration and our common ancestry and our common bonds as newcomers to this land is what created this music, and it keeps it fresh.
A house band plays there 5 times a day, every day, and there is always a long line waiting to get in, even during weekdays. Preservation Hall is a major tourist magnet in New Orleans' historic French Quarter, which combines cultures and traditions from around the world. The Spanish and French, Creole and American, all left their mark in this city that is like no other in the United States. Preservation Hall hasn't been remodeled since the early 1960s, when musicians were first invited to play in what was then an art gallery. The walls of this historic building are adorned with old photos. The locks are old and rusty. Floorboards creak. The interior, together with the music that's played there, preserves the aura of the club.
We take a boat to the land of dreams. Heaven on earth, they call it New Orleans.
About 18 million tourists visit New Orleans every year to listen to this truly American music. In this city, jazz sets the tone, in parks, over the Mississippi River, and welcoming visitors at the International Airport, named for Louis Armstrong, jazz legend.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can find us online at iTunes and SoundCloud. We're, of course, streaming on VOA Asia Facebook, and you can find the program in its entirety at voanews.com. Not only today's show, but you can also go back if you so desire. Here's some past shows as well. We'd love to hear from you. VOAAsia at voanews.com is our email address, and you can also message us on VOA Asia Facebook. You can also hear us on the radio. PSU Radio, Patani FM 107.25 at Prince of Songkla University in Thailand. Thanks to everyone there who's tuned in. Our thanks go to Director Tracy Carter and Engineer Dan Crafton, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. Have a wonderful day.